We made this.
Hi.
Have we met?
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall.
Time to fly.
And if you're chasing rabbits,
if you want the truth, Neo, you're going to have to fly me.
The only thing that matters to you is still here. I know it's why you're still fighting and why you will never give up.
You don't know me.
No?
Years to be going back to where it all started, back to the Matrix.
Hello and welcome to Real Talk, the official film podcast of the We Made This Podcast Network. I am your host for this week, Kurt North, and this week we will be taking a closer look at The Matrix Resurrections. Real Talk is a movie podcast that examines the good, the bad and the ugly of the large screen. With me this week is recurring host and guest Dan Owen, who was with me on another We Made This Podcast Network show, a podcast 616 a few weeks back, talking Hawkeye. But this week we're talking movies, Dan. How are you?
I'm good, Kurt. Yeah, thank you. Looking forward to this chat about Matrix.
Yes, it's going to be an interesting one because I've already seen some of your tweets and I think you already have an inkling about the way I feel about it. So I think this will be an interesting discussion. So it's going to be an interesting one, I think. In general, we're recording just after the new year. How's your Christmas been? Have you had a good time? Have everyone stayed health safe and well?
Yeah. I managed to get a few days visiting family and stuff this year, which I didn't do last year. So I was quite grateful for that. I didn't do much for New Year. I don't tend to do much normally, to be honest.
Right. Okay.
It's quite too pricey, isn't it? I did my own thing. And 2022. See what it brings.
Well, I've had a slightly different take on Christmas and New Year. I luckily managed to have a Christmas day, and ever since then I've been in this thing called isolation because I've got some sort of SARS thing called COVID. I don't know if anyone's heard of it, which I've still got at the moment. So I'm sweating a little bit, but I've been well enough to come onto the show. So. Which I know has been slightly delayed, but overall, generally quite well. I believe I may have caught this actually going to a cinema to see a film that was released on the 22nd of December. I wonder what film that may have been. It might have been The Matrix.
You suffer for your art.
I suffer for my art, and I'm here to talk about it. And hopefully this will be the bookend, and tomorrow I'll be bright and breezy.
If you feel sick, you can always pop a pill, you know, red or blue.
Well, I could. Yeah, whether or not it is a choice is another question. But let's dive into this. So first up, what are your general... I believe you've seen this just the once, is that right?
Yeah, just once, okay. Yeah. I don't tend to see many films more than once, to be honest, in the cinema. I usually just wait for Blu-ray because I'm kind of more eager to see it by then, because it's normally a few months later. So I'm not one of those kind of people who just watches things over and over, to be honest. So yeah, it's just the once for me.
Okay. I've seen it a couple of times. It was available on HBO Max in America. So I will leave it to people's imaginations how I've watched it two or three times since. So I've seen it, I think this is my fourth time I've seen it actually. So I think that'll give an indication of where my general thoughts are on with this. What did you make to the movie? What were your initial thoughts?
Well, I'm like a huge Matrix fan. You know, the first film is quite an important one for me. It's kind of one of those tentpole films, I suppose. When you think about all the films you've ever watched in your life, there's always like certain ones that stand out as being like a bit of a game changer for you, or something that really expanded your own kind of tastes and led you down different paths to other kinds of films. And Matrix definitely was one back in 99. I even enjoyed the sequels, to be honest. I was quite a defender of Reloaded even at the time. And I wasn't so keen on Revolutions, but I can kind of defend enough about the sequels that I'm kind of happy to say that I like them. Although I do agree with like lots of the criticism that you see about them. So I was really excited about this fourth installment. Never thought we'd kind of get it because it's been like, you know, 18 years since the last one. And I think the Wachowskis were never very keen. Apparently they were always being asked to come back and do another sequel, and they'd always refused until recently. And even then, only one of them has actually returned. So I was really excited. I love the trailer that we got for this as well. I think it's one of the best trailers for last year. Brilliant trailer. You know, I could still watch that trailer again, even now, and get goosebumps. You know, I think it's really well put together. So I was really excited. And I'd seen like a few little reviews of this before I'd gone in to watch it. And they were kind of, one was really positive, one was really negative.
Okay.
So I was thinking, I actually quite like that, to be honest. I quite like it when the film's like that, because I think, okay, well, maybe I'll, you know, have an extreme reaction one way or the other, which is better than just thinking it's okay.
Yeah.
And so I went in and, you know, I appreciated what it was trying to do, and I like that it did something different and did just give us like a Matrix 4, essentially. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like a standard sequel. It was trying to do something a bit different. It was kind of like a quasi remake, you could argue a little bit and stuff, but it kind of had enough new ideas there that I was quite kind of into it to begin with. But just as it went on for me, I just kind of grew more and more kind of aware that it wasn't really gripping me. And I was actually finding quite long periods of it fairly boring at times. And once like the central kind of like mystery had been resolved, which, to be honest, it was kind of obvious what the mystery was, because, you know, we're obviously in the Matrix, because the very first scene, you know, sets that up. We're back in the Matrix. So it's only really like you're just waiting for Thomas Anderson to cotton on again that he's stuck in the Matrix once more, minus some memories and stuff. So it was kind of like waiting for the main character to kind of catch up to me, I felt, after a certain point. But there was some enjoyment in what was going on with all the meta that was happening. Yeah. It's quite entertaining. And then once it kind of had moved into the second half, I suppose, with the more of the real world stuff coming in, there's some stuff there that I enjoyed and some new kind of bits to the lore that was quite interesting. But I was just getting increasingly aware that there's nothing really gripping me about this. And then, you know, the stakes were by design a lot lower. Obviously, you can't kind of save mankind twice, yeah. I suppose, you know. So it was kind of more personal, which in a way is good, but I don't know. I just, by the end, I was just, I was walked out a bit kind of on the fence. And then I thought, I'll just sleep on it for a night and just think about it. And I did that. And it's now been a week or so, isn't it? Something like that. And I'm just still kind of, I'm kind of down the middle. I don't hate it, but I do not love it. And I do not understand reviews that are giving it like 5 out of 5. I just cannot even imagine why you'd give it 5 out of 5. Even somebody who likes it, I just don't understand why you give it like a perfect score or something. It's just not on par with the first film in my mind. Especially the action sequences. I think even people who do like it have all said that they're disappointed in the action. And for me, that was like a big part of what The Matrix was. And it was all about ideas and, you know, a certain level of cool and sci-fi ideas and stuff. But there's always like a grounding of action there, wasn't it? It was fundamentally an action film.
Yeah.
So to kind of have disappointed on the action front, to me, is like a huge sin, you know. So I was kind of very disappointed in that, just, you know. So the more I think about it, I mean, I reviewed it on my own website, if you want to go there, so framerated.co.uk. But I gave it like 2.5, which is straight down the middle. In a way, I was kind of fence-sitting, I suppose. You know, but I would, you know, if I had to round it up, I would round it down to 2, to be honest. And that pains me. It pains me to say that. And I like that people, I think such as yourself, liked it more. And I've heard some kind of chatter from people who've liked it, and they kind of fight their case. And some of the things they say does kind of turn me around a little bit in certain areas. And I think, okay, maybe I need to watch it again just to kind of like get that aspect that I didn't get that somebody else has enjoyed. But I just cannot imagine watching it and having it improve my mind radically.
Okay.
So for me, it's the worst Matrix film,
right,
to be honest.
Right, okay.
Although I kind of do know and appreciate that it's kind of done more interesting things than Revolutions, definitely. But yeah, so that's kind of like where I am. How about you?
Okay, yeah, so that's a lot to take in there. I mean, it's okay. Just a couple of things I'll pick up before I say my thing. What did you make to the, you mentioned about the trailer, what did you make to the actual marketing? Because there was things on Twitter that were being displayed at like timestamps, which took people a little while to get into. It was like, oh, right, that's a timestamp for the move, for one of the first movies and stuff like that, which was relating to like sort of aspects of the film, so kind of pointing in that direction. You know, the whole deja vu stuff that was coming out on top of that. There was like one of the first things that came out was choosing the red or the blue pill, and you saw like 5 second clips, and the time would come up exactly what it says on your international clock. It would tell you the exact time that you're clicking in. What did you make to all the kind of stuff that I haven't seen that much of in recent history, but it's something that Matrix has used in the Wachowskis have used quite a lot in the past. And other shows that have done that in the past. But what did you make to the way that they used social media on this? Especially given, and we'll go into a bit of spoilers shortly, but given that there is some social commentary and social media commentary in the film?
Yeah, well, it makes sense to advertise it more on social media, doesn't it, today, for the audience that likes Matrix films. It's all about technology and stuff. The only one that I really took much notice of was the initial thing with the choosing of the pills. Which I thought was really clever, how it gave you little kind of random clips from the film or the trailer. So, you know, no person apparently ever got the same collection of clips. So that was really clever. I did quite like that. I didn't really notice much else, to be honest. You mentioned some of the timestamps that they put on Twitter and stuff. I kind of think I did notice a few of those things happening, but I didn't really pay much attention, to be honest. It was mainly the initial red pill, blue pill thing that I liked. And also they did the tie-in with Unreal Engine 5, didn't they?
Yes.
For the PlayStation and Xbox. So I did download that and I had to play with that. And so that was just kind of interesting. For me, it was mainly that trailer. The first trailer that they released was amazing. But when you do watch that trailer again, it does dawn on you that they pretty much put in every single good moment and like interesting shot, apart from a few areas that would have been too spoilery. But so, you know, sometimes, you know, the marketing people, maybe they knew that this film was going to be a bit of a hard sell and it didn't have that many interesting action sequences, so they literally had to package together, you know, the best trailer they could possibly do. So they kind of got 2 minutes worth of all the best stuff, put it together with one of the tracks that plays in the film as well, the White Rabbit song, and kind of like created a brilliant trailer. But yeah, it does seem to me now that trailer's maybe one of those trailers that's designed for a bit of damage limitation, I suppose you could call it.
Yeah, and I think in context of COVID and the fact that, I mean, I actually work in a culture and arts centre which has a cinema, and my background is in projection. So actually kind of, you know, a lot of people at my work will come to me for opinions. And we've only got a two-screen cinema, so it's difficult for us to have Spider-Man and The Matrix in the same because of contractual obligations that Warner Brothers and, you know, Marvel will put on, Disney will put on you. Both have been like, that. They expect you to put on, you know, four times a day, you know, so many days a week in the first 2 weeks. And, you know, then the eventually what will happen is that the contract decreases, so, you know, you'll get a better return on ticket prices once you get into like the 3rd to 6th week, for example, you'll get a better return on tickets. So so the one big thing that we were talking about was you know, the Spider-Man versus Matrix thing, and I had to say, look, you're gonna have to put Spider-Man on, that's going to be the bigger film no matter what. So, which, you know, and if you look back to the way that Matrix was originally going to come out, it was going to come out the same time as John Wick 4 originally. So stuff like that, which I can see why, that, you know, there's an element of, you know, there's got competition with, which has been, I think Spider-Man is actually a $1 billion movie now. So the fact that at time of recording, so the fact that, you know, you're coming up against a behemoth like that, it's very difficult to come out the week after that to come out. Well, not even a week. It was what, six, not even 5 days, somewhere around there. So yeah, so it is a big hill to climb. In my general reaction to the film, without going over some of what you've said, I would say similar to you, I would agree that there's certainly the elements of the first part of the film had me absolutely gripped to the screen. You know, from the very first seconds of like, oh, they're going down here, to halfway through the film, it had me completely won over. I was absolutely really, really enjoying it. I have some alternative theories and discussion points, which we'll talk about later, regarding the action sequences, that I actually think some of it is deliberate, the way that it's been done. I'm no doubt that other people have suggested this. My natural instinct for TV shows and movies is that I do like meta. I do like, there's a X-Files is a perfect example. There's two or three episodes in X-Files, which is one called Jose Chung's From Outer Space, which is literally different people telling different stories from different viewpoints and how that all relates to each other and all that kind of thing. So a lot of meta is within that, and also an episode later on, which I wanted to sort of relate to the Matrix as well. So Inception, things like that, that is my natural thing. Same as you, I was a huge Matrix fan when I was 19, 20, when the first Matrix came out. I can see immediately to my left that I've got the box set with the Animatrix in, and, you know, so all of that was really good. Revolutions is the one film that I've maybe only watched once or twice. I think I've watched it two times, and potentially three recently when I've done a full rewatch. And there's a part of that to me, which I'm glad I did before going into the movie, because I think you need to, there's a lot of elements that you not necessarily need to, but it makes sense to watch these three films first before going into the movie, to even if just a refresher. But I'm sorry about my heavy breathing, by the way. That's the COVID in me. So the stuff like that's happening. And I thought that it was really interesting how they took elements from all three movies rather than just maybe reconning some of the first one, which you've mentioned. And the second half, yes, I would absolutely agree, is it goes downhill in the second half. I'm not in any, there's nothing in me that says, you know, this is a fantastic movie from start to finish. There's definitely a drop in quality as we get into the later aspects. It becomes a bit more mundane, a bit more, and you kind of know what's coming in some ways. There's elements with it, it's kind of, which is interesting, but doesn't really land properly and things like that. But doesn't spoil my general liking of the movie. I think the movie itself is a 4 out of 5, which is what I put on my Twitter. If I was doing more of a percentage, it wouldn't necessarily be that much. It'd probably be like a 75% kind of thing, you know, if it's around there. So it's definitely something that I would say is a good 7.5 out of 10 for me. Really, really enjoyed it. I would say this is probably on par or just above Reloaded for me. I think Reloaded, the same as you, is gets a lot of stick, and I think it's actually quite a good movie. There's certain elements I'm not fond of in that movie either, but I think this is on par or just above above Reloaded. So that's our general discussion. So I think, is there anything we want to say before we jump into the main discussion?
Are you saying it's the second best Matrix film?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's a big statement. Yeah. Yeah. So I think the problem with the Matrix as a franchise is that you'll never beat the first film because it's essentially a mystery film in a sense. So you don't really know what's going on. You know, people forget this, don't they? But back when we were watching it, I think we're about the same age it sounds like. So when we were watching it, it was all like, what is the Matrix? You didn't really know what it was, you know, so you had to go into the film and watch to find out. So everything that you discovered along the way with Neo was like a revelation to you as well. So it was like you were just kind of going down a rabbit hole with Neo, you know. Mm. So it's all this kind of sense of discovery, which the sequels can never replicate. So they just went down a different path of kind of trying to widen it out a little bit and explore the lore and stuff, take it to the real world a bit more, which was stuff that like audiences didn't really have that much interest in. So it does make sense that with Matrix Resurrections, they've kind of gone back to the original and thought, okay, we need to present another mystery. I think the problem, it sounds like you enjoyed this more than me, and I did enjoy this aspect, but the problem is for me is that the mystery here is, it's kind of interesting and intriguing in the moment when you're watching it, but ultimately it's just the same thing again. It's just that Neo is Thomas Anderson again, he's in the Matrix again. The only kind of difference now is that he's kind of been given a false identity and thinks he's a video game developer who's created three games called The Matrix. Yeah. So there's lots of chances to have some jokes and references about the original films, which is all kind of like funny. But it's kind of easy to do that. I know you said that you enjoy it. And I kind of like, you know, like you say, like X-Files episodes back in the day were quite famous for little Easter eggs here and there. And you'd get an episode of Millennium even that would reference X-Files and that kind of thing. And it was all kind of really, oh, look at this. And when you were watching it as a younger person. But the older I get, I think it's kind of easy to do that. You know, it's very easy just to drop a line in that references a previous film and stuff. I think you have to do something more interesting with it. And for Matrix Resurrections, I think they sometimes did. And there was kind of clever little nods and lines here that was quite subtle. But sometimes it was like being very, very on the nose about everything, and at times that just kind of like it just got a bit boring to me. It almost came across like a bit of a fan film at times. The level of referencing going on, it was like, okay, yeah, we understand. It's kind of hitting us over the heads of it a bit more now. So that's where it kind of like on a rewatch. I think the part of the film that I liked, I'm just dreading watching it again because I think the second time I might not like that part as much the second time, which would be a shame. But obviously you've seen it four times, so it did. That's not the same case for you. But what do you think about that? You didn't think they went too far with it, all the references?
Well, no, I mean, as I say, we'll jump into this discussion then, because I think it's probably good to start with this, because just with us being on this. So how did you take that then? How did you take the references? Do you just reference it entirely within the Matrix world? Because the way that I saw it, it was looking wider than that. It was looking at things like, you know, your Star Wars is in the Star Trek's of the world, you know, the Indiana Jones stuff coming back. It was looking more at like the world, our real world as such. It was for me, it felt like it was commentating more on that. I mean, yes, obviously there's certain aspects in this movie where they're actually saying Warner Brothers want us to make this movie. We've already made three. We said we wouldn't come back. But, you know, and part of it is Lana basically saying, you know, the fact that there's been other script workings in this film itself, that they were going to make a Matrix no matter what, I think, eventually, because the IP is that strong. Mm. So she decided to make it herself. But I think there is more to think there, and I think the whole movie does this as well, and I'll keep coming back to this over the discussion, is that the whole movie seems to be talking as a commentary on where we are in the world right now. And it feels like it's talking about certain IPs within the world, as I say, like the modern Star Wars, the recent Star Wars there, and stuff like that, really. I mean, obviously you've only seen it once, but did you focus purely on just the fact that it was talking within the Matrix itself?
Yeah, I did pick up on that it was you know, more broadly kind of criticizing sequels in general and that kind of thing. I did kind of get that. But for me, obviously, the references to directly The Matrix stood out more. So hopefully, yeah, I'll watch it again and I'll pick up on more of the other kind of lines that are there that are poking fun at other kind of things. But so, yeah, you've probably just got the advantage there of seeing it numerous times to have kind of collected all the other kind of little lines and stuff happening that I haven't done. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's all very well to do that, but sometimes it's kind of like almost at times I remember when I watched it, is that I felt like it was almost chastising fans for wanting a Matrix film, like a sequel. And kind of, I don't know, it was like it was, I mean, you know, I think we'll get onto this, but with the action not being particularly good, a lot of people have said that's intentional and stuff. Yeah. And these kind of arguments to me is like, well, why would you come back to make a Matrix film if you've got no intention of giving us a Matrix film? I understand, like, you'd want to do something that's going to surprise us and not just give us a load of bullet time scenes that are kind of more complex than before and that kind of thing. But, I mean, the sequels did something different. So I'd have preferred just something that carried on the story of the sequels in a sense, which we kind of got here in the back half.
Yeah.
But I just didn't appreciate all that kind of referencing just over and over in the start, which was kind of entertaining, but just didn't sit well with me after a bit. We just stayed in that mode for too long. And it just wasn't surprising, essentially, I think, you know, because once Neo's woken up, he's in the Matrix. So, I mean, I was half thinking at the start that maybe it's going to blow my mind and really take us down a rabbit hole, you know, and have it where like, you know, Keanu Reeves is actually the character, but it was very quickly, that's Thomas Anderson, isn't it? So I was thinking when I went in, because I knew there was some meta stuff happening, because I'd kind of picked up on that from people talking beforehand. So I thought we were going for a real mind bender where it was going to be taking place in our world where the Matrix films maybe exist. But yeah, I don't know. Their approach there just didn't really, I don't know, it didn't quite work for me. I don't think anything they were doing really went as far as it could in kind of blowing my mind, really. Yeah. I mean, the bit at the start with Agent Smith and the replicating the first scene of the first film. And Agent Smith is played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. So I knew he was in this film as Morpheus, but not Agent Smith. So straight away I was like, what's going on here? You know, so I was really into that. And then it's like, he's like a program within a program, isn't he? And he kind of is Morpheus as well. So all this was kind of interesting. And, you know, but so there's little elements along the way where I was kind of like hooked by enough to keep me watching. I mean, ultimately, you're just watching the same film again. You know, it's just Neo, Thomas Anderson coming to realize he's the one, and you know, it just followed the same beats essentially. And maybe that was intentional. What you're saying, it's a commentary on, you know, giving people the same thing repackaged and that kind of thing, which is fine. But I don't know. I think at a certain point, you need to, I don't know, just take things in a different direction. A really surprise us, not just reference backwards and you know.
I mean for me, we'll talk about that opening shortly with Morpheus and Smith and stuff, but for me, I think the biggest thing that I took away from it is there's things like the analyst with dealing and the analyst talks right through the film about, you know, if you look at the architect going back to Reloaded, who was dealing very much in Colfax, and he had the Oracle to look after him, and the analyst is kind of like this new program that's dealing with emotion. And I think, and from what you're saying, I agree with to a degree. I think that there is almost like a kind of like screw you kind of attitude towards the fact that she's been forced to make this, you know, it's not being forced to make it. I think that's probably the wrong word, but to commentate on the fact that she's happened to make this. And I'm referring to Lana Wachowska here, that there is a bit of a commentary on that. And there's a bit of maybe, the, you know, taking it to a degree of like, well, let's point directly at Warner Brothers. Let's there's a scene in the if we're talking about the Deus Machina scenes where they're talking about the remakes and you see Thomas Anderson for the first time, and there's the what's that song, the White Rabbit's song, that's in there. There's that montage, and that montage is really interesting because it's the same guys and girls in there saying the same thing, but in slightly different sentences. So they'll be like, You know, there's one guy saying about the grey space, it really messes your head. And then the next scene is them going, oh, wait, yeah, I love the way The Matrix did, because it really did your head in. And it was all the same thing. It was kind of like repeating, as you mentioned, about the fact of regurgitating that. And there is like a, for me, there is a directed thing at sequels in that way, because it feels like that they are that she is saying, I'm kind of being backed into a corner a little bit and I have to make these films. What I think the overriding thing for me, and the thing that really, really got me, was dealing with the analyst and dealing more with the emotion of it rather than the, you know, kind of subverting the fact that it's not really the reason why we're not getting the bullet times and the grand schemes and the grand fight scenes is that she's trying to switch it to feel like the analyst says this at one point in the film where it's like, the whole thing about desire, the fact that you need desire and fear, and it both works in the same way, and messing with people's heads that way, and actually, you know, making people feel that they're in a position of, you know, the fact that they really want something, but when they get to the point, they're too scared to do it. So there's like, for that, there's like emotional beats within the whole film, which I think is what she's really trying to get at, that's the important part. And I think this is the snipes that you're talking about during these scenes in the first, I don't know, 40 minutes or whatever it may be, where it feels like it's a bit more direct and meta in that way, which I love, don't get me wrong. But I do think that overall, I think some of the aspects which people are not liking is the fact that she's decided to go down more of this emotional, you know, joining, you know, the non-binary stuff. It's the fact that, you know, we need to work together kind of thing. And also the fact that you've got this strong emotional core and dealing with that more than they being snazzy and having all the fight scenes and stuff like that. Whether or not that works, I know it won't work for everyone, but it kind of worked for me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I did appreciate this film was funnier than any other Matrix film, and it had a bit more romance in here. I mean, the Neo-Trinity relationship in the first film was actually one of the weakest parts of the film, in my opinion. It doesn't really connect. So when Trinity kind of reawakens or revives Neo towards the end of the film, it's done enough to make that work, but their love story was never particularly strong. I actually think the sequels are better for that, for developing Neo and Trinity. But yeah, this film was very much focused on their relationship. It's a little bit one-sided though, isn't it? Another criticism I had is that it's very much like, I suppose they're both aware that there's a connection there when they touch hands especially, but it's mainly like Thomas Anderson being very unsure. You never really got it from the perspective of Trinity and her family. There's actually quite a big story there about her family's not real, and you know, and what's her side of things. I didn't quite understand why the film pretty much benched Trinity for the entire middle section and then just brought her back for the ending. I didn't quite get that aspect. If it is going to be designed to be more of a comedy romance rom-com even, you know, then bring those characters together, you know, a bit earlier, or have them interact a bit more and stuff. It was a strange decision I thought, to have Trinity pushed into the background so much. But then she comes roaring back at the end, and there's almost, you know, don't want to rush ahead too much, but the kind of where we leave Trinity is like a huge, you know, decision that on the part of the writing. But there wasn't really much to anchor that. You know, we didn't really follow the story from her perspective at all, even though she had a arguably more interesting change in her life, really, because Neo's just a random loner, essentially, developing games in this world. But she's somebody with family and husband and stuff, so she's going to be losing all that.
Yeah.
And discovering that the guy in the coffee shop is actually, you know, her kind of
soulmate, yeah. Kind of thing.
Soulmate, yeah. Yeah, that's the word. I think basically Lana Wachowski is in a very different place today than she was when making the original Matrix films. She's obviously, after Sense8 that they've made, she's obviously developed more of an attachment to kind of emotions and this kind of thing. And so I can see all of that kind of bleeding into this film, and there's nothing wrong with that. I just don't see the argument that you have to have one or the other. You know, I think you could have got all of it together. I'd have loved to have seen like a Matrix where it's very romantic, very funny, but it's also kind of having this self-aware angle as well. But it's also delivering a good, thrilling, action-packed Matrix film. I don't see why you can't get all of that together. So that's where I kind of fall. I just think there was too much that was pulling me away from embracing the parts that I did like, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I mean, I would absolutely agree with a lot of what you said, because, again, for, look, say, Cloud Atlas and Sense8 were one of my notes I was going to mention, that she is in a very different position to where she was. Sometimes with this kind of genre, kind of like sci-fi trope, that there's things that get missed like that. And I completely agree with the Trinity thing. I was going to mention that myself, that it seems like the only real kind of discussion that we have is in Simulate, which is a lovely pun, where she talks about, and these are things that really I found really fascinating and actually kept me in the movie. But they're so small that they need to be, as you say, need to be developed. And I'm having to, if I'm being honest with myself, I'm having to push myself a little bit to get there when I shouldn't really need to do that. So things like when they're in the coffee shop together, they start talking about social commentary, about, you know, what is the social norm, you know, and stuff like that, which, you know, we know that Lana Wachowski has these themes that she talks about all the time. Because of who she is. So I completely get that. But when there's like elements of like Neil talking, who hasn't had kids and hasn't really had a relationship, or we'll say Thomas Anderson, this is the case, and you've got Tiffany, who obviously is playing, where she's like, did I decide to have kids? You know, why was that decision? That sort of stuff is the stuff that needed to be mined. It needed to be like, do you feel forced into being, not necessarily forced, but social commentary. I've used this in other podcasts I've talked about before. I think it was a Star Trek one, where is it the social norm for people to be able to walk into the office one day and say, and somebody goes, all right, are you not married yet? Yeah, you need to get that ring on that finger kind of thing. And it's like, that's not your decision to make, but it's a social norm that people expect. And you hear it in the office day in, day out, different things. Or, you know, you've been married in 2 years with two kids and whatever. And that's the kind of thing that Tiffany's dealing with there. I just like to have seen that stuff like that develop more, because that's where she was trying to go with it. And I feel that sometimes throughout this, it did get kind of like stuck in the both worlds. It kind of like was like, but I need to be a Matrix movie. So that's where I feel like there's a conflict. And that's why the second half kind of suffers in my eyes.
Yeah, yeah. See, as you're talking there, I'm just suddenly reminded of WandaVision, weirdly. Because in a way, there's parallels to that TV series, because... you know, Wanda and Vision, you could almost equate to Neo and Trinity, and they're in like a false world, and they've got like kids who aren't really in existence. They're kind of created, in a sense. It's kind of like what Trinity's dealing with, isn't it? Having a kind of false family. She's not doing this herself. You know, the analyst is doing this, but she's kind of living in this false kind of bubble, if you like, a fake world.
Yeah.
But a nicer world. It's a nicer Matrix, isn't it? It's not all green tinted, and it's a bit more. Bit more presentable, I suppose, you know. But WandaVision got it right, because it was always like two characters there. One kind of knew what was going on a bit more than the other. So Wanda was Neo, and Vision was Trinity, in a sense.
Yeah.
In that kind of thing. So WandaVision did that a similar kind of thing well, you know, because it had the two characters. You could see both their sides. At certain times, certain episodes, you were following Vision and what he was up to and how he was discovering things, and also Wanda and what she kind of really knows. And I'd have liked that kind of thought behind the script here. I was thinking it's very much too one-sided. It was very much still just always following Neo. And by the end of the film, you know, it's they're kind of like, you know, the one becomes the two, essentially, you know, or love is the one, I suppose, is the message. But it's very much like they're on equal footing at the end. So I'd have liked a film which put them on equal footing, and we actually pass between each of those characters. I just don't understand why it's very much focused on Neo again. You know, I just don't understand that decision.
No, I mean, you're right. I think if I had my go around again, that you would have liked to have seen is that, you know, potentially, actually, Mark Kermode mentioned this on his podcast, about the fact that the first half almost feels like it's just a little side little project, almost like, you know, there's a little TV movie in there, or, you know, it feels like a little one-off thing. But that just came to me then. But when we get to the fact that Neo leaves the Matrix, that why don't we see Trinity like sort of getting, you know, becoming, for less of a better term in my head at the moment, becoming the one, you know, seeing yeah. her, seeing her reaction, seeing the kids more, and, you know, and as you say, kind of that WandaVision thing is a great kind of callback to that, because you don't see the breakdown of her feeling. Towards the back end of this movie, she just turns up to a coffee shop, you know, with like loads yeah. of police on. It's like, well, where did that come from? Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. And this is coming yeah. from someone that likes the movie, but it was like, I felt that a couple of times watching it going, but she's just literally had that two conversations in a coffee shop, and she's now, she's realized she's in the game, and she wanted to kick Chad so hard, which Chad is, he's actually the writer of John Wick and the, stunt double for the Matrix originally, which I thought was a nice little meta thing, but done differently. But it felt like I would have liked to have seen more of that. That would have helped with this whole idea, which we'll talk about shortly, with the analyst and what the analyst is doing and the reason why he's created this type of Matrix. That would have been really fascinating.
Yeah, I'd have loved that. If Neo was in the real world and then it kept on just taking us back occasionally to see what Trinity was up to, and she's beginning to see or spot odd behaviours in her kids, maybe, or certain things makes her think, are these kids real? Or are they just programs? Or maybe moments of deja vu happening for her and just little things. I'd love that, because you've got a sense that things are changing for Trinity, and maybe she's even wondering, where'd that guy from the coffee shop go? Because he's now gone, hasn't he? Yeah. He's now kind of left the program, sort of thing. And maybe just little things, because... Yeah, that sense of discovery, I would like to have seen that with Trinity, really, because we've had the film where Neo wakes up from the Matrix. So in a way, it would have made more sense to have Trinity go through that and even put more of the emphasis on her as a character, make her, you know, a true co-lead of this, or even the lead. Anyway, we're not the ones making the film, but yeah, it was definitely an area where I thought, oh, I really did not like what they did with Trinity there.
Yeah.
Well,
if you flick it over to say, so just changing tact a little bit, because we'll talk about Neo a little bit here, that the scenes with the analyst, I won't talk about the analyst just now, but the scenes with the analyst and the fact that Deja Vu is the cat and the cat can change, can reprogram. Yeah. I thought that was great. That was a great little part, that, and I loved those scenes. But the fact that he was counselling and he was like having to ground himself and all the psychiatric stuff there, I was glued to the screen at that point. Just loved all of that stuff with the Deus Machina, and the fact that he was trying to ground himself. He didn't really know. And I did like Keanu Reeves acting in this way. He was like, he wasn't quite sure what was real and what wasn't. And that whole like sort of thrown into the air of like what's real and what isn't, and things are bleeding over into the game and things like that, which I do have a bit more of a social commentary on, which I'll talk about in a second. But what did you make to that part of the thing? Because it felt like Lana was potentially putting more into Neo and dealt more with Neo than she did with Trinity, and Trinity was almost like a byproduct of that. And I think that's probably where it came from. But what did you think to Neo's kind of line at that point?
Yeah, well, I liked the... analyst scenes with Neo. Yeah, it kind of made a lot of sense. I like the idea that he was being given blue pills as like a treatment, and that was actually like keeping him in this Matrix. I also like the idea this is like a kind of Matrix, almost like a little prison. Like, it was almost like a side prison. Oh, actually, I wasn't even sure in the film at one point if this was like the Matrix or if it was just like a kind of side venture that had been designed just to put Neo in. I don't know if the film really sold or revealed. Was
yeah,
it
during the scenes with Sati, she talks about that the programs were resetting the Matrix back to an older version, and the only reason why the analyst got to keep it was because he was given this chance to sort out Neo, and the fact that he basically knew, because of his dealing with this is kind of the stuff that I really liked about the film. Was that because he was dealing more with human emotion and human feelings, that he knew he could have a hold over Neo by saying, yeah, either come back to your pod, or, you know, or you basically, you'll see Trinity die. What are you going to do? And his analyst and emotional psychology was, well, he's going to go back to his pod. And it's only because of the Sati's got the plans by the father, who was Ramachandra, that program had the plans for the thing. So this was like a one-time opportunity, which for me gets a bit keymakery at that point. I was like, you know, and there's a building, and in the building you must go to this. And I was like, oh, all right, okay, we're doing that again. That stuff like that got me a bit like, oh, come on, that's just a direct rip. but yeah, so it was like an earlier version of the Matrix, and that was kind of where, as I say, that's where that came from.
Right, okay, yeah. See, this is all good stuff, you see, because when I watch it again, I'll pick up on a few other things that are leaving me scratching my head a little bit. But yeah, I did like The Analyst, and Keanu Reeves was, I think he was at his best in some of those scenes. He's not always the best actor.
No.
There was a few areas in this film where I thought, oh, he didn't do a good job there. There was one scene in the toilets with Morpheus.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that one.
Yeah, it was really ropey.
No, yeah. It's not happening.
Yeah, it wasn't very good there, was he? But yeah, I liked that. I mean, I liked the fundamental idea of what was going on. You know, he's kind of imprisoned again and stuff. I mean, one thing, again, another nitpick, I suppose, but quite a big nitpick is, you know, I kept on bumping up against this when I was watching the film, is that if he's the, you know, a video game developer, and he's kind of created the Matrix in his mind, and so he knows the films, essentially, he created these films, so he has all knowledge, doesn't he? Would you agree that of the Matrix and the sequels? But they're just video games in his mind. Okay, so why was he so kind of like confused about things, or, you know, every time like Bugs appears or some of the other characters and kind of like tells him things, he's never like very quick to understand, because they're basically just telling him what he already knows from the games, what's happened before. It's all knowledge that's very much, well, I know this, yeah, I wrote this, this is a video game. So I never got a sense that he was like being presented with, like, his creation has come to life, and he's kind of like confused because, oh my God, the stuff I know is happening. This is Morpheus, you know, he's a character I created, and his, you know, all this kind of iconography that comes in through the games is real and it's happening to me. And I never got that aspect of it.
Yeah, I think there's... Again, it's been about, well, it's been a good 5 or 6 days since I last watched it, because I watched them 4 times, but I watched them in like 3 days or something, 3.5 days. I think there's aspects of the fact that he feels unbalanced, because he feels that the Matrix world and the real world are like a blending, and he doesn't know what reality is anymore. So there's an element of that kind of like feeling of like, you know, this can't be right. I need to get back to reality, but the reality is obviously not reality.
But he's aware of the concept, isn't he, of the Matrix?
He's aware
that you take these pills, you can wake up in the real world. So he's going through that stuff. So I don't understand why it was such a surprise to him, in a sense. He kind of like, he should be just as, you know, he should be on par with what the audience is expecting to happen. Or
the biggest thing you're probably saying is that, especially the fact that he's taking blue pills, which should be a kind of indication that he's like, you know, I can see that. Yeah, I can absolutely see that. Yeah, there's a little bit there, which I think, which is ironic. Yeah, I think you'd have to rewatch that, man. I might have to rewatch that, thinking about that. But the blue pill thing is probably the best part for like suggesting that he should be a bit more turned on to that. There was some cut scenes in that montage, that going back to the White Rabbit song stuff, is where he's actually trying to fight, and he's like sort of, you know, there's a few scenes throughout the movie where, you know, on the train he tries to start kung fu and he gets knocked over. He's playing the Matrix itself, which is the thought, that's him playing the Matrix in the Matrix. He's already created the Matrix, but now he's playing the Matrix. And he's trying to fight and he's not quite there as well. And later on, obviously, when he tries to fly, which is quite a funny moment. There's all of this kind of like sort of coming into play, that he's not got the same skill set in this Matrix, in this version of the Matrix, because he's not the anomaly anymore. He's basically the program. He's actually the main reason why that Matrix exists. So he's not an anomaly of the program anymore. He is the program, which I found that quite interesting. And part of the argument of the fighting scenes is the fact that he doesn't really quite get the concept of how this program works, even though he should, because he's becoming aware that he is the main reason why this Matrix exists, rather than being the anomaly. But then again, the anomaly has its own kind of freedom, because he's trapped in the Matrix. So the stuff like that, I'm still like analysing myself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I still took it to be, for example, that he was still the one and had all the same powers. It's just that they found a way of not having him fly in this, because it was always a bit of an issue in the sequels that he could do that. Because he was still able to slow down bullets and all the stuff that it is like no other person is able to do that. You know, Morpheus can't do that. So he's still got like powers above everyone else at least. So I took it that he was still the one, to be honest, in this. But then towards the end, you know, jumping right ahead though, the ending here is that, you know, Trinity's also got equal powers, or so it was. I don't know. That's a different kind of kind of worms to open, I suppose. But
well, I think that the point for that is the fact that they're both. If both of them don't exist, that matrix falls apart, and that's the kind of, yeah. You know, even though he's out of his pod, the very nature of those two can think, part of the thing the analyst says is the fact that between that desire and fear is what's creating this angst, and this angst is actually creating more energy. So the fact that it's creating more battery life, which, you know, links into the previous ones, is that they are integral to his version of the matrix. So the fact that they're both, you know, are set aside and are like, you know, they're not like a AA battery, they're a car battery. So the thing where it's just like understanding the new programming and how it all works. So I think there's an element of like he's having to rediscover how the program works, because he is an old, that his like source code, as they keep talking about, which has always bugged me about the source code when he's outside the matrix. But but his source code, which they talk about when they're rebuilding him, that it took him a while to get his source code back. So he's not quite the same person. So I give him credence for that, and that's probably me projecting more than anything else, really. So what did he make to this opening? Because it does really good for like sort of, oh, they're playing the scene from the very first one. This is very interesting. There's a lot of the self-aware stuff, but I liked what they did with Morpheus, because I thought Morpheus was going to be a problem in this movie. And it's probably Smith who's probably the one that's more of an issue for me. But the way they use Morpheus, as you say, he was Agent Smith in the beginning. He kind of like, he says exactly the same thing. He is just a program that becomes self-aware, becomes sentient by the fact that he's been put in this modal, and this, the whole fact of this idea of Matrix 1 being this modal, which will create the new Morpheus, and the fact he has got a bit of Smith in the programming, and he's not the Morpheus we're expecting. And then obviously talking about Morpheus in the real world, because we haven't talked about the real world yet, but in the real world, about how he couldn't let go of this idea of, you know, sides, and part of the movie, a lot of the movie is about the fact of what they've created once they've managed to work together. So the way that they've created Morpheus for me worked really well, because it kind of like gave him, it didn't have to do like, you know, what say Chris Pine had to do for Kirk. He didn't have to become the same character, because he is a program that's evolved himself. So how did you think that worked?
Yeah, I think it was good that they gave him some leeway, so he didn't have to kind of copy what Lawrence Fishburne had done exactly. And he had a few moments where he was a bit more levity, wasn't there, with him, and his style of dress was a bit more flamboyant and that kind of thing. But I mean, ultimately, I think I'm a bit less keen on it than you, it sounds like, because I don't really understand why Morpheus had to be in this. I don't understand why it wasn't just another character who provided the same role as Morpheus, and he has a similar mentor role. And it's like, well, just create another character to avoid all the issues. The only thing I could think of is that they did it on purpose to kind of like generate some discussion beforehand, because people were talking, weren't they, about who's he playing, how's Morpheus back?
Yeah.
And it did generate some chat online about this.
In world, and this is me fighting in the corner a little bit, in world, it's meant to be that he's kind of created that modal. Neo has been dumbed down, effectively. He's kind of been held in his prison. And the modal is kind of a way to, like, the fact that Morpheus is the way for getting Neo out of that, because subconsciously he knows who he is. It's kind of like sort of, and yes, you're right. If you talk out of world, it is totally more to do with that. It's more to do with the fact that, well, we need to bring Morpheus in. It will raise some questions. It will do this. It will do that. But in world, it's kind of like designed as like a subconscious thing that he set this modal up, hasn't really understood it, but it's a way to get him out of the matrix, because it's actually Morpheus himself.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, again, you know, if I watch it again, I might actually, yeah, in what you've said there, if I watch it again, I might think, okay, yeah, I kind of get it now.
Yeah. And I've forgotten what I was going to say next, but that's
the fact. I think Smith is a good one to talk about, because, I'm a big fan of Hugo Weaving. I think everyone who likes The Matrix would agree that Hugo Weaving is one of the best things about it. Even the sequels, I think he's He's the MVP, as they say in America. I mean, Agent Smith is like a classic character, one of the best villains in cinema history, I'd say. Definitely like sci-fi. So it's a real shame they didn't get Hugo Weaving back. You know, apparently there was issues with his scheduling and stuff, and he does look noticeably older. So I did wonder if that had something to do with it. They didn't want somebody who looks like he does nowadays, because he is in his 60s, I think, now. Yeah. Jonathan Groff, who I like in other things, he's really good in Mindhunter, Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a very talented person, but he is just not a villain kind of character to me. He doesn't have any sense of threat to him. I think he'd played it nicely in a way. You know, he was believable as like a kind of douchebag, you know, video game guy, you know, whatever. But as soon as he was like supposed to be a threat or threatening, it just kind of fell apart for me, especially because he's been asked to sometimes repeat lines that Hugo Weaving did. And, you know, he makes a wise decision not to impersonate Hugo Weaving. But I don't know. Why have Smith? And I know maybe there's a reason for it that you can explain, or you read the Wikipedia, you can kind of grasp it a bit better. But I was thinking, well, you know, just bring in another character who's a similar character, yeah. Another agent or something. I just didn't see the point in bringing him back. I felt sorry for Jonathan Groff really having to play that role, because he's just not going to be a you know, he's not going to do anything close to what Hugo Weaving brought to it, and he didn't even try to in a way. So I was really disappointed with him.
The idea was that it Smith is like the antithesis or the nemesis of Neo, and or the reflection, because he was reflection quite a lot, like in the beginning, the very first opening scene. Is you actually see the cold and the police officers going into the into where Trinity is as a reflection rather than anything else. So I think reflections work quite well. And I think the same, the idea is that Smith is held like Neo is in this prison because that's the best way to control them. I wouldn't necessarily say miscast, but it doesn't really have the same resonance. And when you've got someone as iconic as Hugo Weaving in that story, and yes, it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing, as you get back to the end of the episode, at the end of the film, in the fact that, you know, it needed Smith to kind of like do this thing and then go, right, well, I'm your real buddy again. Here we go again. But I just didn't, that is an element that didn't really click. It works to a degree, but it doesn't get there.
It also damages Revolutions, because the ending of Revolutions has Agent Smith totally erased, because there's that direct connection through Neo, and the machines are able to kind of inject some kind of erasing code or whatever to kind of like wipe out Agent Smith once and for all. So to me, it just didn't make sense that he was back, to be honest. And so there's a little part of my kind of nerdy brain thinking, how is this kind of square away to what happened in Revolutions? And I know you can get away with everything. You can make an excuse for it. And, you know,
yeah.
Lana Wachowski is the co-creator, so it's her thing, you know. But as a fan, I was thinking, well, for me, it doesn't quite work, you know, and it kind of damages, in retrospect, some of Revolutions for me.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely agree. I think it's in its story taken out of context, I think I understand it. And it also kind of like plays out with, if I talk a little bit about towards the end of the scene, when we've got the analyst in the cafe again, and we're talking about Trinity coming in. And that scene there, that plays out basically like Sense8. It's like you can imagine that being one of the season enders of Sense8, where you've got all these things happening. There's about six or seven different characters. I made a GIF file on my Twitter feed of it, because I was like, that is just basically people looking to the left or right of the camera in slow motion. And it's like, that is just Sense8. It's like, and that was, yeah. And I've seen people online saying it's just basically a TV. In some ways, it looks more like a TV show. I mean, TV and movies blur quite a lot now anyway, but there was that. And it's kind of like, it filters in with all these like sort of look backwards and forwards and all this kind of thing. And then you've got the kind of the swing is that Smith is the one that helps them. But it comes from nowhere. It doesn't. There's nothing in sprinkled in during the course of this film where it's like he's going to do that, you know, because there's nothing between the analyst and Smith really that you actually see. So the fact that the analyst and Smith aren't together and don't have any, you know, any kind of beef with those two. It comes out of nowhere and say, "Oh, right, well, that's a bit of a cheat." And I do feel that there's a bit more to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being surprised by what happened with Smith at the end, and I quite liked the idea that he'd been like temporarily on Neo's side for his own selfish reasons and stuff. But yeah, like you're saying, it wasn't really foreshadowed cleverly, was it? So you didn't think, oh yeah, of course.
Yeah.
You know, there was none of that. It was just like, oh, okay, yeah, this is happening now. So I know what you mean. But going back to another thing you said there about it looking like a TV episode, I mean, that's one of the criticisms that I've heard even people who like it do admit it doesn't look like a film. Apparently it cost $190 million, and I do not understand that at all, because it does look like a big budget TV pilot to me a lot of the times. And they keep on doing clips, don't they, to the original films, which are kind of like look so much more lush and kind of filmic. And that green tint, you know, it's iconic, the green tint. Yeah. So having none of that in this film has almost made it, you know, more and more feel not like a true Matrix film. It did seem like a bit of a TV spin-off at times.
Yeah, I mean, the green tint thing, the very end of Revolutions, there's the whole colour palette comes back. So I get why they've kept that, because that was 1999. This is meant to be 2021 or whatever it is meant to be.
Yeah.
In the Matrix world, because obviously, you know, it's 2274 something like that. I think I saw it was somewhere around there. Anyway, I'm not fixated with like dates and stuff. I know there's a lot more people who go, well, the Ebuchadnezzar was in 2132. This is 2274. It's 100 and so many years more later. But it did show a day, and I thought that's deliberately there to say how many years has gone by. So I get the color thing, and yes, I would agree. Again, going to the fighting scenes especially, that if you put them side by side, I haven't done this and I haven't seen them, but I can pretty much imagine in my mind now that a lot of the fight scenes in the first three Matrixes were wider shots with a bit more pace into it. And part of me likes what they've done with this, where the shots are closer. I've heard that Lana did work on storyboards in the first three movies, that she didn't really do it in this one. But the shots seem to be a lot closer, a lot more personal. So like drawing in the audience into the scene, and things like, you know, the fact that during the fight scenes, when Neo's not fighting, it's like, it's that subversion of like what you expect from the Matrix, what you expect from those fight scenes. And while I agree with it to a point, and I think that the idea of having these closer personal fights works quite well. I know there's some, like, you know, the bit where Smith is like really going at him in the train bit again, where it replays that scene. I take your point that it still could have been a bit more propulsive and a bit more of a fight scene as you get into it, rather than what I felt was probably the biggest downfall of it. Was he just kept using his hands all the time, and especially towards the end, there was not one bit where he even really tried. He just kept using his hands, especially with the helicopters on the roof, which had to be done. But he's been doing that with all the full swarm in the past 20 minutes of the film.
I love the fights in the original films, especially the first one. And I like the wide shots because you can really see what they're doing, and you can tell the actors are actually doing these moves.
Yeah.
And they do like quick close-ups on certain punches and impact points and stuff to really sell it. This one, you know, you can do a good fight scene when it's closer in and stuff and a bit more sort of gritty, I suppose, and that kind of thing. But I mean, I'll have to watch it again. I've only seen it once, but I was disappointed because I couldn't even tell what was going on half the time. In the train scene especially, it was just like a mix of things happening. I really didn't find it easy to follow what was happening there. There's that scene with the Merovingian when he appears, that kind of fight that happens in that area. I mean, half of that just passed me by. I was literally struggling to kind of follow it and to kind of get excited by what I was seeing. It just wasn't fun to watch, sort of thing. I mean the cast went through a similar kind of boot camp again, and, you know, learning how to fight like they famously did in the original film.
So
they did kind of like do some training again, so it wasn't all just like a reliance on stuntmen and stuff this time. So I don't understand why they didn't sell that more, you know. Especially Keanu Reeves, he hasn't exactly been a slouch of action films in the last 20 years. You know, he can do a lot more, I think, because of John Wick.
Well, you look at you look at John Wick 3. I mean, that was only a couple of years back, wasn't it? Maybe three or four years ago, and that fight scene in the
so much better
hotel was massive.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I know they intentionally didn't have Neo fire any guns. I've read a piece saying that they intentionally had that.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, he intentionally didn't fire any guns. There was no kind of guns, lots of guns reference, which there might have been being so meta, but they didn't do that, did they? I don't think they did.
Anyway. Well, the only time that's mentioned is in the montage scene where it says guns, lots of guns, and it starts talking about bullet time and stuff like that.
But yeah, so he doesn't fire any guns, but I don't think he did in the sequels either, did he? Because he could fly and he was more of a godlike character in the sequels. Yeah. So I don't think he fired guns. I wasn't too worried about that. But yeah, like you're saying, he relied a lot on the force, really, didn't he, in this? He was like pushing people away in bullets and stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot of that in the trailer, but I just thought that was... just picking some iconic moments, but in this, in the actual film, he was literally doing that all the time, and I don't know why they decided to do that. I mean, Keanu Reeves could have thrown some punches and kicks and looked good doing it, even at his age.
My nuanced approach on it is that I liked the concept of it being more personal and more aggressive and maybe more, you know, within the fight scene of itself of Smith and Neo going at it, but not. Like you get at the end of Revolutions where they're flying around and they're swinging around each other, or even in the first Matrix where they're swinging around each other, but have it more personal and more, you know, grounded as such. And I like that idea. But I think what you're saying, and I kind of agree with, is that it kind of fell back too many times on him using the Force, basically, you know, because it just relied too much on that. And it was like, right, are you just not going to have a bit of a just... Or even like, I mean, Trinity does the scorpion kick, I think, once. And it's like, and even like, there's a kind of a recall back in the cafe scene where Neo's underneath all of the programs, and he jumps up and spreads them out like he did with Kente and Smith and Reloaded. And then they're kind of surrounded around each other, and Trinity and Neo are trying to reach each other. And I get it from a thematic point of view, and I get where she's coming from by saying, right, okay, well, they're going to be a lot more powerful once they get together, touch hands, and then everything happens. But it's like they are a lot better than that in fighting. You know, there's an element of like that. But for me, I think it's more a case of like it relied too much. There was like the fight scene in the train station where the Merovingian was on top, and I'll talk about him in a second. There was that personal fight scene which worked. There's the fight scene at I can't remember what they're called now. They're called dojos, aren't they? With Morpheus, which, you know, he's kind of being reluctant and he just uses the Force again. Where it's like, that could have been a bit more, that scene for me could have been the one that you needed that a bit more reaction to it, because then he just uses the Force every time and it's like, well, all right, yeah, it's maybe easier. The Merovingian was quite interesting. Did you actually catch it? It took me about the third time to work out what he was talking about. Did you catch what he was talking about in the show?
Do you know? I really did not hear a single thing he was saying. To be honest,
it took me a while.
I don't know if it was I don't know if it was a sound mix or it was just. I mean, in that scene in general, I don't want to harp on about this too much, but you know, I wasn't really into it at that point. I was just getting more and more disappointed in the fighting. And when the Merovingian turned up, I thought, I knew he would be turning up in this film. I'd heard that. So I'd had that spoiled. But having him turn up and be like a homeless person, essentially, it was a bit of a surprise. But then I thought, okay, what we're going to do here then? And he was just some crazy guy screaming at the side.
I can't remember exactly what he was saying, but he was effectively the audience saying, the way it was indicated, it was kind of like him being... I want the Matrix like it was. That basically, that's what he was getting at.
I'll have to watch again. And if he is saying that, then that's kind of like, for me, that's kind of disappointing, because that kind of, to me, that means that it's definitely the case that Lana Wachowski went into this with that mindset. You know, there's nothing wrong in being a fan of the Matrix and wanting a good Matrix film. And if part of what we consider a good Matrix film is good action and bullet time and stuff, then that's what we want. You know, I don't want like a film that's just slavishly giving us only that and not pushing it further. But why deny fans that? Why criticize through a character in that way? I don't understand that.
The kind of gist I got, that was kind of what he was saying. So the only other thing that I had down is the kind of the social commentary, which I wanted to talk about, because there's within this movie, it feels like, and I mentioned the X-Files before, there's certain things where 1999 was a very different time. It was before 2001, September 11th. It was before YouTube, which I think was maybe 2004, 2005, somewhere on there, and Facebook and the like. So we're in a very different world now. And I think part of this thing that this film is trying to talk about is the what's your own objective truth. There's a scene where in the montage where you're looking at the reflection of Neo inside the lift where everyone's on the phone and everyone's like looking at stuff like that. And there's elements in this as well about, you know, the fact of, you know, having your own beliefs and stuff like that. And the swarm, I feel, is like probably the biggest aspect of that, that, you know, you have your objective truth. And in 1999, The Matrix was talking about, I think I saw this online somewhere, The Matrix was talking about like the man and the machine and, you know, how we can't, we've got to live together because, you know, if the machine goes down and, you know, and the world stops, then we're in trouble. So it's got to be, you know, and it's the machine needs us, they need, we need the machine. And this kind of like discussion on like the swarm is more like, what's your objective truth about, you know, everyone's like just reacts to whatever's happening. So there's an element of like that in my head, that the way that the swarm reacts is like, you know, that they've been switched on and, you know, you can be in your own Twitterverse or your own Facebookverse, you know, post truth and all that kind of thing. And there's a bit of play on that. And did you catch any of that when you were watching it?
Yeah. Some of that. Yeah. I mean, I'd like to have seen it go a bit further with some of those ideas, because like you say, 1999 was very different. We're in a very different place with our relationship to technology. I think actually nowadays we're actually kind of more kind of likely to willingly accept the machines, yeah, if you like.
Yeah.
So in a way, I was half expecting something where the commentary to go along the lines of like everyone who's in the real world living in Io, they're seen as like the saps, because where you want to be is in the Matrix and have it like flip.
Yeah.
So that people want to be in the Matrix now and they don't want to come out of it. And have it like that, because really the reality is pretty dire, isn't it, in this future?
Yeah.
So I thought they were going to do like a commentary on where we are now with technology and Facebook and social media, where everyone's kind of like really, really on board with it and willingly giving up all their kind of personal data and stuff for the benefits of it. So they could have had an angle with that, where everyone's, you know, willingly returned to the Matrix. Everyone likes being in the Matrix. They don't really want to escape the Matrix and flip it. But they didn't really do that. But yeah, I mean, the swarm thing was an interesting idea. I wasn't quite sure if like the swarm was real people being taken over and killed, essentially, because that seems to go against like the machine's need for batteries. So were they willingly sacrificing some people at that point? Or was it just like they were all like digital people just being used? I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, and I read it as it was different. I've seen this a couple of times now, and I was absolutely dead cert that it was the analyst who switched on the swarm. And then someone's mentioned about Smith doing it. I'm like, no, Smith didn't do it. And then I've second guessed myself now, but I'm pretty sure it is the analyst who switches them on.
Are the swarm real people though?
I think I was just about to say that. I think they are. I think that's the concept, is that the analyst is, again, this is kind of like part of the aspect that I quite like. The analyst is using fear and desire and emotion to fulfill the very nature of the Matrix. So the fact that you may desire to go out the Matrix, but you fear actually leaving it because it's actually a better world.
Yeah.
And or the fact that the swarm has switched on because, you know, without going down the route of like the Trump kind of thing, but, you know, he's switching on what he believes. So making them feel that Trinity and Neo have to be stopped. So he's switching that on. And for me, the swarm is like, right, okay, let's get Twitter on this. Let's get that feed. And that's the way I felt, that it's real people doing that. So
And I agree. Yeah, that was interesting. It was one of the highlights, I think, in that final sequence as well. Just the visual of them all diving off the skyscrapers, you know, and hitting the floor. Quite upsetting, really, to think what was going on there. And yeah, definitely. I mean, there was, like I say, lots of parts of this film that I did like. You know, I don't want to come across like too negative. It wasn't like a terrible, terrible film that I'll never watch again or anything. Just touching on other things I did like, because I do want to end on the positives.
Yeah.
I did like some of the updates to the lore and stuff that they did. I liked the fact that 60 years later, some of the robots are actually on our side.
Yeah.
And there's some like friendly kind of robots look like, they look like nice insects, don't they? Look like ladybirds and beetles, nice insects, not like the horrible ones, like the squids and stuff, the evil ones. So I liked that there was like that there.
with that, what I liked about that is, again, it kind of like forms on this social media aspect of, like, you know, part of that point of the film when they're looking at Io is that you've got the side, and we touched upon Morpheus, we didn't really touch upon it too much, that Morpheus wasn't willing to let go of his beliefs that, you know, it was us or the machines. And I found that fascinating, because you then move into Io, where because of the beliefs that they're them working together, Io wouldn't have been possible. And that's what Niobe says, without the fact of working collaboration. And you've got this other aspect of inside the Matrix of the Swarm. So I think there's a lot of social, like, commentary on, you know, what the Swarm being, what they're doing. You've got Io, and actually people who are a bit more enlightened, and, you know, and the Swarm would probably turn around and say they're too woke or whatever it may, you know what I mean? So there's definitely that kind of aspect to it. So I just, while you were talking about Io there, that I think that's really interesting. I thought the 60 years thing was a good amount of time to say, you know, Neo, you have changed. You did change that, because otherwise it was like, he actually, within the film, starts to say, well, what was the point if nothing's changed? And it's like, actually things have changed. So I like that.
Yeah, exactly. I could have done with more of that, really. I did like seeing what actually happened after Revolutions, what the state of play was. I liked the mirrors.
Animatrix 2.
I liked the mirrors were now kind of like the old phone booths. They were like the kind of entrance and portals and stuff. That was a good update. I liked the fact that the programs could come into the real world as well. The Morpheus did that. He came through and he was like kind of like iron filings, wasn't he? kind of hovering around in the real world. I liked that idea.
Programmable matter in Star Trek Discovery.
Same kind of thing. Yeah. I liked that. I liked the Io having fake sunlight. Was good. That's good for them. But yeah, there's lots of little things along the way. So I appreciated seeing that. But yeah, I'd like to see more, though. And like you say, just in talking here, there's lots of kind of questions that arise that I just wish they'd have got into it a little bit more. I mean, I'd definitely like to have seen or have got more of an idea as to what people now think about the Matrix. You know, is everyone plugged in? Are they aware of what's happened? Was everyone woken up and given a choice to go back in?
Yeah.
You know, what happened to everyone? Did things just stay the same, but you're allowed to be woken up if you want to? Or I just don't know what the kind of politics was between, you know, after the peace had broken out. What's really going on now?
Yeah, because that would have been interesting, because I think they did say about that, the fact that, you know, they still needed the energy to survive. So I think that there's a civil, because there's also the civil war between the machines as well. It goes into a bit of a kind of thing about the fact that, because people were starting to leave the Matrix, they kind of got realized what was happening, that the energy started to sap because people were leaving the Matrix.
Right.
And that's why the analyst kind of like took that form, because he realized that by using emotion, that he can actually get more energy out of less people. So that's like the story that's played out. But it would have been interesting, as you say, just playing on what you're saying, whether or not this happens or not, is actually within the analyst's matrix, whether or not they know that, because he hints at the fact of this desire and fear thing, and whether or not, you know, people are just happy to be in the boxes that they're in. If you are, you know, a conservative, you know, voter, and that's it, you're not going to move from that, or, you know, and stuff like that, that you're in your box, or, you know, you've got your Twitter like rows and stuff like that, that You're only ever gonna see. So if you like I did with this film, I typed in the Matrix 4 Resurrections or whatever I put in into Google to have a look at what people were thinking, and then for the next week, all I've had in my Google feed is Matrix 4, like YouTube videos pop up, or this happened and that's happened, and it's like it feeds into your own psyche of like, well, I like the Matrix 4, well, I'm gonna like it even more because I've watched it again. It has the detrimental effect for people like us, because we're watching it because we're going to talk about it. But if somebody's like puts in a certain keyword, it feeds back into them. So it's like you're never getting going back to objective truth. You're never getting an objective truth, because you're just getting your subjective viewpoint. And it would have been interesting to see if the Matrix and the analyst Matrix would have fed in more with that, with like, well, we know we're in the Matrix, but, you know, I don't care, you know, because it's, And that goes back to the X-Files thing I was talking about. There's an episode called Lost Art of Four. It's where there's a character called Dr. They, which for people who don't know, doesn't matter. It was in the revival, ironically. And Dr. They basically says, well, what is truth? Truth, it doesn't matter. You either believe it or not. And there's no point lying about anything. Well, not let lying about anything. There's no point hiding anything anymore. Like 1999, we would have hidden conspiracy theories, all that kind of thing.
Mm.
Because people are just going to believe what they want to believe. So just tell them what you want to tell them.
So, yeah, definitely. Yeah. We're basically a society of ciphers now, aren't we? Wanting our stake, essentially. Yeah. It's all flipped.
And I didn't notice that, but I saw something online today and I was like, oh, I did not see that, because Neo at one point, he's eating a steak.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I was like, oh, right, I didn't notice that. So I think now we're on a bit of a high point. Any other high points you want to mention before we call it a night?
I don't know if it's a high point, but I think we've got to touch just a little bit more on the ending, haven't we? And what this might mean for future films, possibly. So at the end, big spoilers now, at the end, they do the odd decision to make Neo and Trinity both have the same powers. I took it to mean, so they're both the one, or love is the one.
I think you're more powerful as one, aren't you? Because I think, again, looking at the way the machines are in IO with humans, that by working together, you're actually greater than some of your parts. I think that's kind of the...
Yeah, or even like a marriage is two people coming together as one, or something like that kind of symbolism. So, but it basically ends up, you know, that Neo and Trinity have got the same powers and they can both fly and do whatever. And almost like an Adam and Eve kind of figures at the end, I suppose, of the new world, and they're going to develop it and do what they want with it and stuff. So it's kind of like echoing or mirroring the first film. Even ends on the Rage Against the Machine song, but now it's a cover with a female artist.
Yeah.
So I know this is going to be quite a divisive ending, I suppose, because some people just don't really like that idea that Neo is no longer special. He's no longer the one. He's now sharing that power or that ability with Trinity. And does that make sense with the other films? Or I know you were saying earlier, this is like a different Matrix, so the rules there don't apply. So you can have two people with the same powers, maybe, or it just runs differently. I don't know. But I don't know. What do you think about the ending? Did you, when that moment happened and they both flew off together, were you thinking, brilliant, that's a great ending? Were you thinking, I've got my issues of that?
Do you know what? I actually, in some ways, I didn't really have an opinion on it. It was kind of like it just happened. I was like, oh, well, they started off the film with the first Matrix and they're kind of finishing off the film with the first Matrix, kind of what you were saying with the kind of play on the fact it's just a repackaged first Matrix, really. I wasn't that, and don't get me wrong, I've seen the actual video footage of them doing this stunt, so of them actually jumping off the thing. But it was like, I was like, right, okay, well, I get they're in the Matrix and, you know, the fact, and throughout the episode, I keep saying episode, I'm so used to doing TV, throughout the movie, you've got Neo that he's on the roof in the first instance, and I think this is the analysts having a bit of control that when he gets to a point of like, am I actually in the Matrix? Deja vu either changes something and he's back in the analyst's mold. So Deja Vu is actually doing a lot of the changing around once he gets this element of control. And there's the moment where Bugs looks up and sees, because they call it a DSI, and I can't remember exactly what that stands for, but the DSI is like, because she sees him as a completely different person. It's not a person we ever see again. So he's been hidden in this DSI, which I have issues with. Because he's like, he's the programming of the Matrix. Why wouldn't they find the program person of the Matrix? That's who it's going to be. You've been looking for 60 years and he's the programmer of the Matrix. So I don't get why, even though it is a DSI problem. I suppose they're looking for code, maybe get away with it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So sees him. So in that instance, the question is, did he end up flying or not? Or did he even be allowed to get to that point where he could potentially fly? And then throughout the film, I think there's two or three more aspects of like where he's on the roof again before Bugs grabs hold of him. There's almost like a revert on that. And before the analyst can switch it, it's now Bugs has managed to get hold of him and actually put him into the Matrix and get him out of there. And then at the end, it's obviously kind of a play on that. So it's like the three stages of like the three acts of him learning how to fly.
Yeah.
Well, it was even that moment where he tries to fly and doesn't, but needs the thing. So Yes, and again, if I go back to the kind of the kind of mythos of what's happening with him, the fact that he's not an anomaly anymore, he is actually part of the Matrix. He's not being built up over. He's not like what Morpheus is as such. He's not become something because of being in the Matrix. He's actually part of it. He's the main one of the main parts of it. So yeah, I mean, long-winded way of saying I'm not entirely sure whether or not I liked it or not, because the stunt, don't get me wrong, I would not do that. But it just didn't really catch on for me when they're hanging there and say, are you doing this? And I was like, well, okay. It was quite a muted ending, I think, for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like the bits afterwards. I did like the bits afterwards, but the actual flying bit was a bit, okay.
Mm. Especially because it looked like she was obviously on a wire, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Holding him. It looked an obvious kind of falseness to that. I don't know. It's just I'm thinking about, obviously, if they're going to do more films, what's going to be like, because they can have two people now have got the problem of being too overpowered. I don't see how you can possibly do another film now. But that will probably be why they'll do a reboot next, and without the Wachowskis, probably.
Yeah, I wonder why if Lana's kind of done that. I mean, yeah, you can always read out, but it's like, because I've heard, I think I've read or seen something in the last couple of days, just passing by on an article because of the algorithms, mentioned that they're not anticipating doing anymore, but they always say that, don't they? They always say, not going to happen, but I think they need to leave it alone personally, but Warner Brothers are in charge, so we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. It hasn't made a lot of money, has it, either, unfortunately?
No.
I think it's made, that's $72 million at the moment, which isn't, like, terrible, but it costs, like, nearly 200. So it's got a way to go, and then you put in marketing costs to that. It probably needs to break at least 350, I'd have thought, around there.
It's an interesting world, isn't it? Because with it being on HBO Max, even, there's an indication of, obviously, did people just like, oh, watch that. That looks all right. We might put it on. Because I think on HBO Max, it's like 31 days before it goes off, isn't it? Something.
Yeah, there's a limit. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I watched this film, or when it was announced, I was desperate to see it in the cinema. And I just did not understand why you'd watch it on HBO Max in America. I felt quite sorry for Americans doing that. But having seen it, I can now say, unfortunately, it's probably a good place to watch it, because it's, it wasn't particularly cinematic to me when I watched it. There was nothing really crazily inventive. It's very difficult, I know, to kind of like reinvent the wheel twice. The Matrix is such a game-changing film, technically. And it was like a decade or more, wasn't there, of different kind of clones of the Matrix and people doing their own versions of Bullet Time. I was quite saddened by the fact they didn't even attempt to do anything particularly cutting edge. You know, they could have really done something. I mean, even the sequels, you had all the multiple Agent Smiths in that scene. That was really, really technically difficult in the day. You had the Agent Smith and Neo fight, which you still see nowadays in superhero films. Man of Steel had a action sequence very similar years and years later. It was always pushing the envelope, but to have not even made an attempt with this film, I thought was quite disappointing. They could have done something, even just like de-aging somebody really well or something, just something to make us think, oh, that was quite a big move on. But they didn't even attempt it, which I thought was a bit of a letdown. So yeah, there was nothing here, was there, on par with the freeway chase or anything like that, really. So
I think you're right, because while I agree or I like some of the subversion that it's been done because of that, the grounded fights could have been something different, or just think completely out of the box and fashion something, just push the boundaries somewhere else. And then again, it kind of goes back to the TV, because you talk about like the Morpheus stuff, I suppose they're trying to like look at that, but there's loads of movies, I mentioned Star Trek Discovery are using like energy matter now, that programmable matter that can move in that way, and it needed to find something, and I don't think having a big centerpiece like the car chase scene in Reloaded, fantastic, the Bullet Time, fantastic. There's definitely elements that they can push, but they could have gone somewhere else that's a bit not expected, and for not to even try it. And as I say, to have this undercurrent a little bit, and I am coming around a little bit to what you're saying with Lana may be in a bit too sour in certain aspects that may have like coloured this film to a degree. Hasn't stopped my entertainment of it. I still think it's a great film, but there is that for everyone that said that they've not liked it, and for people who have actually put a proper critical point on it, I understand why and I can see why, but that hasn't personally had an effect on my enjoyment of it.
I just don't see why you do a Matrix film without bullet time. It's like doing a Rocky film without boxing.
That Lily wasn't there. So what does Lily normally bring to the table? You know, there's also that to discuss as well, really.
This is the interesting thing, isn't it? In general, when you get writing partnerships and they split up and then you watch each of their separate projects and you kind of begin to work out, oh, right, I bet she was really good at the sci-fi ideas and the other sister, in this case, was really good at the action or something. And you're missing in this film the person who was good at the action, possibly. Mm. But I know they didn't bring back, is it Yanwu Ping? I think his name is. The guy did the waifu, original film. He didn't come back for this. So he was probably, maybe they were missing him or the stunt coordinator. We think we mentioned it before, didn't we? Chad Stahelski.
Yeah.
I think he was a stunt coordinator or quite involved anyway in the original films, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
But he wasn't actually stunt coordinator in this. He just had that cameo, didn't he? So maybe they were missing him.
We could go on for another hour, I think, with certain other things that I'd like to talk about, but I think we've come to our time now. So, okay, no problem. Let's call this an end to this coverage of Matrix 4. So thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of Real Talk. Dan, if people want to hear, you mentioned about your review of Matrix 4 earlier on, but if you're on anything else, and where can people find you online?
Probably best to find me at Twitter, DanOwen79. Find me there. I mentioned the website, so framerated.co.uk. Just go there. There's lots of people writing for that website, including me. That's the best two places to find me.
Okay, excellent. You can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. I'm on a multitude of different shows. You can find me on the XCast, which is the X-Files podcast, and that's the X_cast on Twitter. Speaking of partnerships that broke up, you can also find me on the Red Dwarf podcast, Shipwrecked and Comatose. That was a partnership that broke up, and one continued on after Red Dwarf 10. So we're not there yet. We're at Red Dwarf 6 at the moment, but you can find that at Red Dwarf Pod. And we've just released, for the XCast and the Millennium Show, actually, an interview with Glenn Morgan, who was one of the writers of the show, of both Millennium and the X-Files. But the Millennium Show, you can find me at at the Time Is Now Pod. And coming up in the next couple of months will be the new season of Star Trek Picard. So that will be me covering that with Luke Winch. And you can find that at Jean-Luc Podard. So a number of different places you can find me. But thanks for joining us on another episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to this show, Real Talk, and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you can, or any podcasts of your capture of your choosing. And if you want to help our network, please consider supporting the Patreon. And you can find that at patreon.com/WeMadeThis. Real Talk is not what we're only discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what that you might have missed on the network in a moment. We'll be back soon. Until we venture back down the rabbit hole, we'll see you next time.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Academy Watch.
I saw West Side Story actually the other day, and I didn't really connect with it. So, you know, some I'll like and some I won't. But generally, I like the idea of a musical. Disney films, the animated Disney films, tend to enjoy them.
Of course. Are you a La La Land person? Because I was a La La pet.
I hate La La Land. I just could not stand it.
Wow. We can't be friends anymore. I'm just going to hang on. How do I turn this thing off?
Yeah. I've lost a lot of friends over this opinion, but I hate it.
Garfield is the best Spider-Man and La La Land is shit. Like, what?
I just like to be controversial.
We dig music. But yeah, just missed out on my list this year. There was the Garbage record was great, so I'd godhead off that.
Yeah, I was surprised that didn't end up on the main.
It was close.
I was surprised to not see it.
Wet Leg, who have released two songs so far. There's another one apparently coming out
terrible
later
band
this week.
Name.
Yeah, I can't get behind it. That's what our old history teacher was called, Mr. Wet Leg. It's actually Westlake, but like, apparently he pissed himself once.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a f***ing terrible band name, but they're great.
It's like if Wet Leg toured with pissed jeans. Can you imagine?
Right in the childhood.
When I was younger,
Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man looks way older than I was as a kid.
He looks older than you do now.
Way older than I am. Yeah, and that was a constant thing in the cartoons as well. Like in the cartoons, like the 90s one, he looked older. Mm. And that was the cartoon I watched when I think it was the 90s one. And we would have done that for this show. But as soon as Disney Plus came out, I binge-watched it all. And then I encouraged you to watch it.
Yeah, and I've watched
and
it as well.
And then we started the podcast.
And we were like, oh, shit, we should have saved
it. That should have been it. And then there was another one with Neil Patrick Harris in, which I probably did.
What, as in Doogie Howser, MD?
Yeah, and, you know...
Barney Ooh, Spencer. I'm going to put that on my list.
A Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser, MD.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.